Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
Salutations. How you been?
I think after you know how many years of doing this that we would come up with some other sort of, I don't know, introduction here that isn't. Consistency is fine, but we're not terribly interesting or diverse in the way we say hello to each other. I don't know why I'm so hung up on the way we say hi to each other every week.
Well. Yeah, I have to say the fact that you mention it every week really doesn't help you with your case to set us apart from our other efforts in this category.
Feel like it's my version of the "You Look Nice Today" bit where they're constantly looking for funding for the show. It's just me constantly searching for a better way to say hello to you. That's going to really grab the audience when they hear it. 347 episodes later.
Yeah, well, it's. You know, 347 episodes, the magic's gone. So it's...
Oh, is that how it works? do we need some couples counseling to reinvigorate the relationship or something?
God, no. To pull back the curtain here for listeners, Dan and I start this podcast by saying hello because we literally just answer the phone. Answer Skype. Skype is the phone. So it's just like a normal phone call where you would say hi first.
Yeah.
And that just... leads us to this, and it's a good way to set things up so that way you can branch off into other topics. And if you start by like exclaiming something or shouting something or saying a thing, you run the risk of the other person not really being caught up on whatever antics you had in mind, and it kind of flounders. So you might as well just start with a nice warm hello.
Oh, I should be worried that you're not ready to yes and my bits if I come right out of the gate too hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Well, I mean, I'm not generally ready to yes and all of the bits anyways, because...
I mean, you got to show up to improv class prepared, right?
You like the ones
warmed up,
prepare.
Ready to roll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, anyway, how's it going? How was your day? How was your week? Your whatever?
I don't know. I can't even tell... how long it's been since we recorded last time. Just mentally,
I mean,
I was trying to
consult the calendar if you want.
I was trying to do it without consulting the calendar. I was just gonna be like, what time frame are we in? Were we in? Will we be in next time? It's a mystery. What has elapsed?
That's really what keeps us on our toes here with the show is all of our internal expectations and how we constantly fail at them.
Yeah, well, busy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of stuff. But enough of that.
Life moves pretty fast, you know. You don't stop and look around every once in a while. Mm-hmm. You might miss your podcast.
Mm, yeah. But I didn't...
Ferris Bueller would have a podcast, wouldn't he, if he were a real person nowadays?
Oh, I think... Well, if Ferris Bueller was a high schooler, he'd have a TikTok.
Sure. Well, I guess that depends on how you calculate Ferris Bueller. If he was of film, if the film was remade now, yeah, he would definitely be a TikTok sensation.
Yeah, he'd be a TikToking youth. I think a podcast is a little too old. Sorry to podcast the fan favorite character of Ghostbusters Afterlife. I don't know. I don't see the kids being real cool with podcasts these days. It seems like it is for. People around our generation.
Cameron could be a podcaster. I could see that.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that would make sense. So Ferris has TikToks, and then Cameron has a podcast.
Would his podcast just be about like his peculiar ailments and the ailments of his guests, or would he talk about more sociopolitical issues?
I don't know.
He seems pretty self-involved.
We didn't really get a lot of insight into Cameron's inner life, really. Other than his,
he's very delicate
issues.
And fragile, though. That's about all we got.
Yeah. So I don't know what he would consider to be like a hobby that he enjoys, but I know one thing's for sure, and that's when Panic Room was filmed. Titanic was a relevant reference for the teenage youth of the time.
That's in the script written by David Koepp, who is well-known screenwriter.
And producer.
Yeah. Did I see in the trivia here? Because, of course, we just recite IMDb trivia. He was paid $4 million for the script.
Sure.
It's a lot of money for a script in 2002.
Well, I'm not even sure. Yeah, it was these $4 million for the script. And it seems like one of those things where he was like watching, I don't know, 2020 or like, what was the NBC like true, like
hard copy.
Yeah. He's watching one of those things and he's just like, wow, a lot of rich people are having panic rooms these days in urban areas.
That was literally one of the trivias there. It's like, yeah. he read something about panic rooms. And he's like, that sounds like a good idea for a story.
Yeah. And then he turned that into $4 million.
And I think it even says somewhere in the trivia, I'll stop with the trivia at some point. He wrote the first draft of the script in like 6 hours or something.
Wow. Well, I mean, it makes sense because if you were to lay out, the writing in here, it requires a lot of like, mechanics of who is where, when, etc. But there's a very tight cast for this, so you're not having to deal with people going to a lot of places and doing a lot of things and interacting with a lot of bystanders, or a lot of dialogue for that matter. So everything's really, really tight, and I think that works to the advantage of the film, because then you can spend a lot of time with the tension, and that is a compliment both to David Koepp and to Fincher. I don't know if you know this, Dan, but the guy can direct sometimes when he really, you know, gives it his all.
I suppose that is the case. Mm-hmm. There was another thing in there. I said I would stop with the trivia, but I'm not gonna. Mm-hmm. About how like, oh, Fight Club, his previous movie, had, you know, 160 something locations, and afterwards he was really keen to just focus on a single location and a smaller cast of actors to deal with. And I was like, I don't know that I see Fincher as the kind of guy who goes like, oof, that last one was a doozy. Let's really just rein it back in and take it easy on this one.
Well, I don't know if it's taking it easy. I think it's just a different kind of challenge. Because you're doing a lot with a little, in a sense, you know? Instead of being consumed by planning to go here and shoot that and go there and like travel schedules and like, where can we set up, to get this, you know, B roll that we need. And, you know, so-and-so's got to shoot this action piece that's over here in this place and we need special effects for it. And it's just like, no, everything's going to be a set in Rally Studios. We're going to build the house on the set and that's where the whole thing's going to be. Now that's not to say there weren't challenges with that pared down approach because of the casting. And that was kind of a curveball I didn't even ever know about until I was just glancing at Wikipedia before this. Mm-hmm. If Fincher was looking for something easy, I don't think that's what he wound up with, because he had a lot of actual, like a surprising amount of turmoil occurred, because he lost his cinematographer, his cinematographer was fired. Darius Kanji was fired and replaced with Conrad W. Hall, who is the son of Conrad Hall, who was not as good as Conrad Hall. And I just want to make sure.
Him.
I just want to make sure everybody knows that. If you're watching a film and you see Conrad W. Hall, you get real excited for a second. Just remember, W is never a good sign.
Also applies to Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yes. Or, you know, certain presidents. But it is a... just kind of a weird thing to have that. But then on top of that, you have Nicole Kidman and Hayden Panettiere. What's her face? From
Panettiere.
Yes, that's it. They were going to be the mom and daughter pair in this. And Nicole Kidman had to drop out because she filmed for 2 weeks and then discovered that she had a hairline fracture that had never completely healed from Moulin Rouge. And David Fincher was shooting around the character, other things that he could film without her being available, and was pressured by the studio into recasting it quickly so they wouldn't have to shut down production because of the strikes that were going to happen. And it's just like, wow, there's just like a lot going on, really, when you think about it. Just a whole array of things you would not expect, where you're just like, this is essentially a play. And it's like, oh, but then everything broke on the play.
Yeah. I don't really remember how much how long Nicole Kidman was on it, but I do know that I have seen some very brief footage of some of those earlier scenes where she's laying in the bed where it's Nicole Kidman, and it's kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, I would be curious to find out what that footage is like. because I'm not a huge Nicole Kidman fan in terms of like her acting performance, generally speaking. But I had always associated in my mind the role with Jodie Foster, even though I hadn't seen this movie prior to today. So I didn't ever really have the mental space to entertain what Nicole Kidman's performance would be like, let alone Hayden's. But I also forgot that Kristen Stewart was an actor who acted in things prior to, Twilight. I always forget about that. Because she was in, Jumper?
For 5 seconds at the end.
Yeah, in her weird cameo. And then she's in this as the daughter. And it's just like, oh, wow, there's an actress waiting to act someday in mm-hmm. bigger roles.
It would have been interesting to see what Fincher could have got out of Kidman. Because, yeah, I don't see... It would have been a very different film, probably. I don't know, I don't see Nicole Kidman in this role, but, you know, mm-hmm. I guess he saw something that we didn't. And I honestly did not even remember the Hayden Panettiere thing. Did they just replace her because she didn't look enough like Jodie Foster or something?
No, it just says that she dropped out before filming began.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
She only signed up to work with Nicole Kidman, and once that fell apart, she's like, nope, done.
I guess, or I don't know, maybe... she's like, I need to prepare for Heroes. several years from now.
Were you into Heroes? That was a big show at the time.
I wasn't, but a coworker of mine was really into it, and he insisted that I watch it. The whole season had just wrapped up, and they had released the HD DVD, and he had the HD DVD player that you could hook up to an Xbox 360, mm-hmm. and he lent me that so that I could watch Heroes. And so I watched the first season. And then when the second season started, I watched the first two episodes and I said, who is writing this garbage? And I turned it off and never pursued it again. Not the reboot, none of that. No, thank you.
Oh, there was a reboot?
Oh, yeah. Well, not a reboot. Continuation? I don't know how to, or maybe.
Oh, it's one of those. They took a break and then they brought it back or something. But
yeah.
Instead of doing like a TV movie, they just brought back a season.
Yeah. But it was like, it was 3 years ago, I want to say. They brought back Heroes for like a hot minute. And it was just like, oh, no. Everybody knows better than to watch this. And so it didn't even last its full, I think, season. It just withered away.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Who did that show VFX-wise? Was that Stargate?
Sure.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. I didn't watch any of that stuff. That was not for me. But yes, I similarly had coworkers who were very into it. But no, mm-hmm. no thank you.
Yeah.
Was that at the same time as Fringe? Did you ever watch Fringe? I probably asked you this before.
I think Fringe was maybe a year or two later when it started and also ran longer. Mm. I didn't watch the first season of Fringe, but Jason liked Fringe.
Yeah.
And so we watched a little bit of it, and I was just like, this is like bad X-Files, but with the Mighty Ducks guy. And so I don't know.
I watched the first season or two. They were really good. They were serious, though. Yeah, so they were kind of X-Files-ish. Yeah, I mean, well, the cold opens were very X-Files-ish, where you're like, ooh, what's this going on over here? But I really liked it, and then it got off the rails, and I gave up on it. I'm curious, actually, what they did with it, but yeah, I let it go somewhere around the parallel universe stuff.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. It's just like, so this whole show is just about the parallel universe, like melodrama now? I don't know. It's less interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, that happens to all the best X-Files shows. Like,
of course. Which favorite show are you watching that doesn't have a parallel universe plotline?
Actually, a lot of them have parallel universe plotlines now in movies and TV. We have a plethora of them, really. Mm.
We have a multiverse of multiverses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what we really need is one multiverse that combines all of them. And then we can have, I don't know, Captain Marvel saves everybody in the panic room. Yeah.
No, I think we should have a Fincher multiverse where in the Jodie Foster's panic room, the people breaking in is Forrest Whitaker, and Forrest Whitaker's Tyler Durden, which Jared Leto in this movie could very well be Forrest Whitaker's Tyler Durden because he's a rich kid who dresses kind of funky. And then, you know, we can throw in some other crossover stuff in there.
Yeah, I would like to briefly talk about the rest of this cast, because it is not, like we said, not a huge cast. We have Jodie Foster, who I think is doing a fine job. She's always kind of like this. I don't know. I'm struggling to think of a time where I've been like, oh, wow, Jodie Foster being something other than Jodie Foster. I don't know.
Disappearing into a role. No, she's very talented, of course, but she's Jodie Foster.
Yeah, no, I mean, you buy into her emotions. You just believe that it's Jodie Foster in every role that she's in. To the point where you don't say, like, oh, it's Ms. Altman. It is, no, it's Jodie Foster. And then you have Jared Leto, who I despise. I'm not a huge fan. And
you're supposed to.
Yeah, but it was, you know, at the time, I believe people were still thinking of him as a talented up-and-coming actor. And I don't think
Who could forget the splash he made with his cornrows hair?
Yeah, I don't think anybody told him that he's not in the Wet Bandits, because in this movie, he seems to be in a different movie in terms of his, I don't know, his performance is a little off from everything else.
He's a crackhead rich kid.
Yeah, but he just doesn't seem to mesh with everything for believability reasons.
Well, I think part of his weird entitled rich kid vibe is that he's living in his own movie.
I guess, but my point is, as someone who was watching the movie, I would like it if he was more cohesive with the rest of the performances that were on screen. Because I don't buy a lot of seriousness from him. And I know, like you're saying, he is an entitled rich kid. And so, you know, when the going gets tough and he wants to leave later, and so he's very flippant and stuff and just can't deal with it because he's an entitled rich kid. That's not really the problem I'm talking about. I'm just talking about, like, there are line readings where he's just a little broad and a little comedic in what should be an otherwise serious or menacing thing that he's supposed to be saying. And sometimes he'll say something that's supposed to be normal in an incredibly strange way, like Raul. the way he says Raul in the film is sort of eyebrow raising, where it just takes you back for a second and you're like, why'd you say it like that? Why'd you say Raul? Raul
it's a code name. We all know it's a code name. His name's not actually Raul.
No.
Whose idea do you think it is between him and Fincher, where he's like, you know, you're this young pretty boy actor, we are going to mess up your face in every movie you're in?
I don't know. I mean, probably Fincher gave him the idea, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea, because I'm too pretty. And then Fincher's like, yeah, sure, whatever.
we're gonna set you on fire. It's going to be great. You're going to love it.
No, but, I mean, but that's why I was happy, I guess, when he died. I have to say, while I found the ending of the film predictable, I did appreciate the fact that they killed him basically, what was it, halfway through? So it really, that did take me by surprise, because I thought they were going to draw it out and then, like, kill him at the end. But it worked well. It was, I'm not going to say, like, you know, it's not like Psycho where they killed Tippi Hedren early, but it is... similar in that you aren't expecting one of the notable people to drop out at that point. Because this isn't like a slasher film, and there's no real reason for him to have died at that moment. But
yeah, but I mean, it's definitely a movie where you're like, the whole vibe is like, you know, we got to tie up all of our loose ends. Everyone, we all know how this is going to end. Everybody here is a witness is going to die. You can't see my face because I'm Dwight Yoakam in a ski mask.
Mm-hmm. Dwight Yoakam is great in this. He's got a lot of Ted Levine energy, where he just seems like an unhinged serial killer that was accidentally invited into this group by an incompetent junior.
He's far too calm for far too much of the first half of the movie for him to be a normal person.
No, and the ski mask is really what tips you off, because no one else in the film is wearing a ski mask, and it kind of has... It has some importance in terms of when it's finally removed and all of that, and how he presents himself. And when he's basically like an undead zombie towards the very end of the the film as he's like coming up the stairs. You know, it's just like he delivers a menacing performance that is pitch perfect for what his character is. And the fact that he kills Jared Leto in that way is what establishes real stakes and conflict for Forrest Whitaker. Because if they let Jared Leto live until the very end of the film and then done all the, you know, shooting then it wouldn't have had as much tension for that second half of the film, where you were expecting them all to die anyways or get caught. And at least this way you could wonder if any of the protagonists were going to be left alive. So I liked Dwight Yoakam. He was good in this. I don't know why he was. I don't know why Dwight Yoakam specifically was cast in it, but he was good.
He probably knows somebody who knows somebody who knows Fincher. And he's like, yeah, you'd be great in this. We're gonna really subvert some expectations to get you in here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have to say that I like Forrest Whitaker, but he's from. The way they chose to edit his performance and the way they chose to have him say everything he's thinking, it doesn't leave a lot to the imagination in terms of the character, like, you know, saving everybody at the end and then being caught.
Well, he's a good guy who's just got his back up against the wall and he's got to do something. And this was going to be an easy job, but it turns out there's people here.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't take any issue with that. I just wish there was more of a mystery as to what it was he was going to say or do or think. Whereas I think it's pretty clear. He spells it out initially, like what his whole role is that he sees for himself in this picture. And that is he wants the money. He doesn't want anyone to get hurt. And that he would rather not have the money and have no one hurt than to have the money and have someone hurt. So it doesn't have a conflict in terms of what choice will he make. It just has a conflict in terms of when will he do the enough is enough. And it turns out it's at the end of the picture. So, you know, that's what you got. But like, yeah. You know, it's fine. Like, I'm not angry at it. I'm not upset with his performance. I think he's a fantastic actor. I just think that in terms of the writing and the directing and the editing and a few of the choices, they could have just made some more mystery in there in terms of what will this guy do? What will Burnham do?
Yeah. Which is, I think what I was about to say, what interests me about this movie, but it's all, I mean, it's not that interesting to me. What interests me about this movie is, why David Fincher would pick this and why these actors would pick this, because it is ostensibly a very, very basic story. I mean, if you were to look at this on the page, like you said, it's very, there aren't a ton of twists and turns and things, and it's not surprising what happens in a lot of the instances. You know, there is a fair amount of tension and drama, but that all comes from, you know, execution. But did they all just say, like, let's take a super simple story and just, like, see how dramatic we can make it? Like, they didn't really care so much about making it more complex than it needed to be, because there's nothing overly complex. I mean, especially coming off of Fight Club, when we talk about how much, you know, complexity and subtext was missed by the audience, like, this has none of that. This is just a, you know, a couple hour long in real world time, you know, dramatic film, and just see how cool we can make it and how dramatic we can make it.
Yeah, this is, like you said, there's no like subtext or like symbolism or any of that kind of storytelling going on here, but it is interesting in terms of the tension that's there, and I feel like that's not to be discounted. I like the film. So we didn't really talk about our like overall opinion, I guess.
Well, but I always ask you that. You're like, yeah. Aha, I'm saving that for the end before I reveal to you how much I did or did not like it.
Well, surprise, I liked it. But I acknowledge that it's not, you know, a twisty turny, like what's going to happen thing. But it, like you said, in terms of how they execute filming certain scenes, especially in terms of camera movement and editing. And I say camera movement, not just like camera placement, because a lot of these shots are constructed in a way where the camera has to transition from one framing to another framing, and that is part of what gives you the tension. And there's
a lot of complexity gone into, you know, there's a CG door here, so the camera can squeak through this like 1-inch wide door opening, which wouldn't actually be possible. Or like the railing here is added back in CG, so we can do this giant boom move from one floor to another floor.
Or the light bulb filament in your flashlight. But
that is just the most unnecessary shot that has ever existed.
Yeah, I have to say that's the one disappointment. I feel like a lot of the reason why I didn't see Panic Room initially, and I say initially in that I haven't watched it until today, is that I was turned off by the trailers and the... I think it was like the SIGGRAPH previews and stuff where it's just like, look at the camera fly through everything. And I was just kind of like sneered at that because it's just like, you can't make a movie out of just like flying through stuff. But in the film, it is surprisingly not as distracting as one might expect.
Because, it's also kind of front-loaded in the movie too.
Yeah, because they, like, yeah, it is basically front-loaded in the film. But it, other than the flashlight one, they all kind of have a story reason for why they're doing it. And the way they plan the shots is very much like as if you could film it with a motion control rig, or you could film it with a, you know, descender or whatever. Like you could cut out a section of the flooring and then move the camera through. Like when they have the camera go from like the first floor to the second floor, they have it go through and you see the space in between the ceiling and the floor, and then it goes up. As if you had just had a set that was missing that element, as opposed to, you know, like we're going to go through the atomic world. You know, it is,
like that shot in Bad Boys 2 where it comes from the helicopter and goes through the air vent down into the rave club.
Yeah, and they don't do that thing where you just like motion blur streak it to hide your transition from one set of, you know, from one scale into another. You're not really. A lot of these are like pans or tilts or, you know, they're just very slow or slow dollies where, you know, they're replacing the kitchen island or something. They're not like we are going to like fly through the like gas pipe or something like that.
It's not like Torque where we go into the front of the motorcycle and then into the engine and then out the back.
Yeah. We don't see internal combustion occur in the film.
Get into the inside of a light bulb filament, as you say.
Yeah, and we do get a nice, pretty blue flame from the air duct. It was wrong of me to have been so negative about it. It was wrong of me to be so negative about it, just based on the flashier shots that they were using to promote it. Because
you were misled by the marketing.
Yeah, I mean, it really isn't that bad. It sits in a pretty tasteful way with everything else. And it's not even as kind of superfluous as it is in Fight Club, because the set, the house, is so important to the story that's being told. We're not like flying from a helicopter, or we're not like going from a brain cell out of a nose, out of a pore in the nose, up at a gun barrel, and then like, you know, rack focusing back into an actual piece of plate photography. It is stuff that sort of makes sense in terms of like, if you could just like cut away these physical reasons why you can't put a camera there, then you could film it. So it is less distracting in that context, I feel like.
Yeah. And the orientation of the house and just knowing where things are relative to each other is a big story point most of the time. So that's useful.
Yeah. Especially since, I will just say that the other floors don't differentiate themselves very much other than I would say the main floor and the bedroom floor with the panic room. When she's going around Kevin McAllister style and destroying everything to set up her, plan at the end, and they're all slowly walking through, I'm just like, oh, I guess that's what that floor was laid out like. I guess you have to walk past that room and over there. But, you know, it is just not really the thing you think about because you spend so much time focused on the panic room and on the main floor. But it's fine. It's all laid out in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. Except that all the doors have locks on them. They can only be locked or unlocked by a key, even if you're on the inside.
That's a very old house.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, Forrest Whitaker is not a slight man. He could have, like, broken that.
Put a shoulder into one?
Yeah, the old, old busted door. But yeah. I suppose...
Didn't want to give away his position, though.
Yeah, I think the real reason is he didn't want to get shot. but, yeah, it was... It's just interesting to see how they really play with that. And of course, there's just like one shot on the street in New York at the beginning, really, with the real estate agent who was too much. Did not care for that performance. And then there's one shot where they're on the bench at the end going through the listings. And for some reason, that one's a Zolly.
Yeah.
I don't know why that one is
It's also a reshoot, but the original shot was also a Zolly, but it was behind them, I think, and it was like the New York skyline in the background. So they were like up on like an elevated platform so you could see them in front of it. But something about not being able to see them, he didn't like that, so he went back and reshot it, this location with the park.
I mean, it's good. It just needed to not be a Zolly.
It was great looking, but I don't know.
What's the point of compressing space in that shot? Just like,
well, he's uncompressing space. He's doing the opposite. So you know, they're opening, they're broadening their horizons. They're opening, they're widening their frame to the rest of New York and opening their eyes to what they need.
Just pull out. Just pull out like a normal person. It's just all you need.
You want to clarify that at all?
David Fincher, pull out. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. We'll snip that out and post that as our teaser for this episode.
As we frequently do with our teasers. I don't know. It's just like that got a little fancy for not a very good reason. And like you said, you know, you could, I suppose, say, oh, they're decompressing. They can finally breathe, blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, but it's the last shot in the film.
Yeah.
Just like,
it'd be boring.
But just let it chill out. The whole point is everything's supposed to be relaxing. A Zolly isn't relaxing. Even if you are decompressing space, it's just still like, why is perspective shifting?
Well, their perspective has shifted over the past 2 hours.
Ugh. Wake up, Vault.
It's art, Joseph.
I don't know. With everything else, it's just like, you just shoot it better than that. I don't know. But maybe he really had to stick up his butt about, you know, maybe we need to do this for reasons.
Yeah. I wish I had more insight into this one, but, you know, behind the scenes interviews and stuff. I know there is a decent amount of behind the scenes stuff on this one, too. But this movie, it's a good movie, but it does not hold my attention in the way some of his other movies do. It's really just the story and the subject matter, to be honest.
Interesting. I think maybe it's my surprise and lack of familiarity with it.
My goodness, how pleasantly restrained this movie is.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's just like, it's just a movie. It's not super pretentious. I would say at times it's like, Fincher's, you know, putting on a little bit of a Alfred Hitchcock kind of accent to things. Not emulating Hitchcock, but, you know, just sort of looking towards that more as inspiration for what some of the choices he's making, which is a different kind of approach than I believe we saw with him in, you know, Fight Club. He came right off of Fight Club doing that. Or The Game, which I hate. I hate The Game. But it is...
Don't hate the player,
hate the game? Yes. Oh, yeah. We just need to make sure that he eventually makes a movie called The Player. And then we'll be set. But it has to be good, I guess. So it's not really a sure thing. But yeah, I just, I don't know. It is interesting. Just in that it is a nice, entertaining picture to sit and watch.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't feel like throwaway stuff. Like this doesn't feel as, it just doesn't feel like gratuitous or like total garbage, as I think we've seen with some other things. Or, you know, this isn't Michael Bay's Panic Room.
I don't think Michael Bay could ever create a movie as small as this.
No, it would have to be in like the biggest mansion in Miami. They'd have to blow it up. And every time a character is talking, the camera will be spinning around them, just orbiting them all the time. And none of the lighting would match for continuity reasons because he'd shoot it during different times of day.
It doesn't matter as long as it's flary and cool. But as good a movie as this is, and I agree, it's entertaining. I don't know. I don't find this to be the kind of movie that I'm really going to think about after we're done talking about it.
No, I mean, well, it's not cerebral. It's not like, wow, really, you know, you ever look at your hand? Like, it's not.
It's not even like, you know, in the conversations of cinema going forward, you're not going to be like, yeah, that reminds me of that thing from Panic Room, which is a great movie that I very much enjoy. Like, this is a good movie that, I don't know, for me, it just doesn't exist unless somebody else brings it up.
Hmm. Interesting. Well,
I don't know.
I'm glad you participated in this because it gave me an excuse to watch it.
You're glad I showed up to the show. No, that is why I'm here in general, is to force you to watch things that you probably wouldn't watch, especially David Fincher movies. I'm very glad to get you to do that. It's just, yeah, this is, I don't know, should I revisit the Fincher ranking list to see where I put this one? Because it's just one of those ones that's like, it's a good movie, but like, you know, what is it?
Yeah, sure. Where do you place this, I guess?
I apparently put it kind of just below the midpoint. So Social Network, Fight Club, Dragon Tattoo, Zodiac, Gone Girl 7, Panic Room, The Game, Mank, Benjamin Button, Alien 3 is apparently my full list.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently.
So middle of the pack.
Yeah, just below 7.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a good movie, but it just doesn't do a whole lot for me, I guess. I don't know. What's something that this movie does that is unique to this movie? Is there something that you felt where it stands out?
No. I think your criticism of it is being, you know, kind of, it has no sharp edges where you would be like, oh, that's something that only the Panic Room could do, except for the aforementioned camera moves. And, you know, that's not the same thing as, like, I'm going to really think about this forever. Like, I don't know. Is anybody studying the camera moves from Panic Room? Probably not. But it is maybe taught as a thread I don't know about.
Yeah, maybe we can inspire him to do a thread on Panic Room's camera moves, and he can highlight all of the things that were added in CG later.
Yeah, but I think what hurts it for me the most is the ending. Even though I enjoyed it, I think it gives you that, unfortunately, very pat Law and Order ending where you're just like, that was a satisfying episode of Law and Order. They caught the guy. You know, our hero.
You didn't
survived.
Feel the dramatic release as he, you know, unclenched his hand and $22 million in bearer bonds went flying up in a swirl of wind?
Yeah. I have to say, I didn't actually know what it was going to be. So when there was broken glass in the film that she's walking over in her bare feet, and I'm just like, wow, that's like Die Hard. And it was like bearer bonds. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is like Die Hard.
Exactly. So this movie is equal parts. You know, you got some Home Alone, you got some Die Hard, and you got what else? What is the Panic Room generally, general vibe about it here? What are the ingredients? But yeah, there's definitely a lot of Die Hard in here.
Yeah. And...
Oh, Hitchcock is the other one you brought up. Yeah, so Hitchcock, Home Alone, Die Hard, and there you go.
Yeah, but I don't know. It is entertaining enough that I would consider this to be pretty inoffensive to watch in a lot of conditions. Whereas 7, I don't really want to revisit because the subject matter is a little tough to deal with. That makes it a little less palatable for me. And then Zodiac doesn't really have an ending. It just kind of just goes boop off into the sunset.
Well, it doesn't have an ending because that's the point. Because there's no ending.
I know, but as a
didn't find the guy.
As a complete cinema entertainment package, it is not that interesting to have a movie where things just kind of go, well, the end.
It's strange the topics in the script, particularly in the construction, that entice David Fincher, because, you know, Zodiac being that very long movie about something that is sort of dear and near to him because he grew up in that area at that time. But like, it's just, yeah, like you said, it doesn't have an ending, but like, he didn't care about that really. He didn't really worry about figuring that out. He's publicly said, you know, the game doesn't really have an ending. Never really sorted that out, but like he's still somehow drawn to these movies and is very invested in making them because he spends many, many, many months and a lot of energy focused on making them. But the things that are just kind of like, no big deal. You know, story, plot, the endings of some of them. It's very strange.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I haven't seen Mank. Have you seen Mank?
I mean, I have seen Mank, but that one also, his dad wrote it and then he revived it and made some changes. So like the script is weird, probably weak, but like at the same time, like, you know why he picked that one. So that's not a mystery.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know. But given the lack of, I don't know, entertainment or staying power or whatever, of the Panic Room as a film, what do you think? Because our initial plan is that after this, we're going to, I think we're going to do Gone Girl. And is that one you rank higher than Panic Room, right? It has,
I do, yes.
It has more going on because it's like more of a story.
Yes, it's a more complex story. It's a more interesting story, more interesting characters, I think. And if you are unfamiliar with the story, which I hope it hasn't been, you know.
Yeah, no spoilers, please.
I hope it hasn't been excessively spoiled. Like, it's been a very long time, but, you know, you got your Ben Affleck in there.
Yeah, there's the whole photo that was going around on Twitter today of Ben Affleck and what's her face pointing at each other, and then that was it for the Gone Girl release. Rosamund Pike.
Do we get the same internet? What, I didn't see any of this. What?
No, I was joking because we had the Spider-Man thing. Them pointing.
Oh,
at each
the Spider-Man thing.
Mm-hmm. It's because we're talking about spoilers.
Yeah. Spider-Man's. Gone Girl is interesting. It's another one. I mean, again, that one's based on a book. Like, he picks books that are popular and interesting. You know, Fight Club was a book. Gone Girl was a book. Dragon Tattoo was a book. I'm sure other
Social
ones
Network
that I'm forgetting.
Was based on a book, loosely.
Yeah. I don't have any interest in reading that, but I am curious how accurate that movie is to the book, because I'm guessing not very.
What was Curious Case of Benjamin Button based on?
God, that movie is such a strange outlier for, I mean, talk about a guy who picks a bunch of random movies, but like, that movie is so weird.
Loosely based on the 1922 short story of the same name by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know. It's, you just option a bunch of, well-regarded literature and just turn it into insane movies.
Yeah.
There are worse ways to pick scripts, I guess.
I suppose. I mean, I don't know. I don't consider any of these things to be a waste of his talents. It was interesting, though, to read about how they had to film this in sequence for a lot of the stuff because they were actively destroying the set that they were filming on.
Beating the crap out of it.
Yeah, and apparently they you know, Fincher infamously likes to do a gajillion takes of everything because he doesn't really know what he wants, I suppose. Some people might critique. But he had to film the plaster breaking scene where Dwight Yoakam is hitting the sledgehammer on the ceiling trying to break into the bottom of the panic room, and the plaster's falling off, and they had to reset it up, and it was several hours. And so they basically spent, what was it, a day or 2 days on what was an eighth of a page on the script. And it's just like, how does he get stuff done? I don't understand.
He has the benefit and the luxury of time, and can spend as much time working on things as he sees fit.
But like, was the first take of breaking the plaster so bad that you needed to do that again?
Well, I mean, to hear him describe it, it's not about whether or not the take was bad. It's that we're here, we've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars every single day to set up this camera and get this set and these actors in this place. Let's spend as much time exploring this scene as we possibly can and make sure that we leave no stone unturned when it comes to the performance, so that when we get into the edit, we can have every option available to us. That's his methodology.
But there's got to be something between Ed Wood and David Fincher for this, you know? There's got to be like some middle
ground. There is probably some diminishing returns after, you know, 20 takes or whatever. And again, most of it happens to be like this is him defending himself, as he often does. It's like you set up your wide, you do 25 takes of it, you move in for your over the shoulder, you do 25 takes, you do your reverse, you do 25 takes, and then suddenly everyone's like, this scene took 75 or 80 takes. And it's like, well, kinda, but also not an individual shot took 80 takes or whatever. It's the construction of everything. But, you know, I understand and see the validity in some of it, but it is not a thing most people can afford, and not a thing most performers and crew will tolerate. Because by the time you get into the teens on a take, people are beginning to sit down and look at their phones in the background, the crew, and the actors are sort of wondering what's wrong with you, unless they've signed up for this in the first place, which, you know. At this point, they got to know what they're getting into with David Fincher, but not everyone else can really pull that off.
Yeah. Well, what was it? Bill Pope. Part of the reason why he didn't do Matrix Resurrections was because of his falling out with the Wachowskis when he was doing the Matrix sequels, and they were filming them back to back, and the Wachowskis had read something in some book, I forget what it was, about how you need to do as many takes as you possibly can to wear out the actors to get the truth in their performance. And so
that sounds like a Fincher thing to say.
Yeah. So Bill Pope's like, this is a bunch of BS. And they would have arguments about that because he's like, you're wasting everybody's time. We're giving up, you know, a year of our life to just be here busting our butts all day, blah, 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 blah. So he was very unhappy about it. And that's why they don't work together anymore.
It depends on, you know, how you're spending the time. Like, if everyone has the time to, like, rest and take a breath and you're not skipping meals or whatever, like, spend 3 days shooting a scene. Like, who cares? Like, that's your job. Like, you don't want to shoot the same scene 50 times? Like, boo-hoo. Like, if they're doing it in the same way that you would shoot, you know, 10 scenes with 5 takes, you're just doing one scene 50 times. Like, who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. You're not wasting anybody's time. This is what you want to spend your money doing, then go ahead and do it. But yeah, I understand. I understand people's reticence to say, like, it's not so much exhausting people as they are, you know, getting so familiar with the thing that you're doing that it comes out naturally. But again, you know, different strokes for different folks, I guess.
Mm.
That's the thing I just said on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this this movie does take a little bit of a, you know, the pace changes once Jared Leto gets killed, because he is a little bit of the, you know, slapstick entertainment for the first half, the bumbling comedic relief of all of the mistakes they're making.
Yeah, he's Marv.
He's Marv. It's true. He is Marv. And then he's gone, and then suddenly, you know, it's very serious business, because it's basically a countdown to how fast you can get through this before Dwight Yoakam kills everybody.
Yeah, he's Marv, and Dwight Yoakam is Joe Pesci.
Oh, that's right, because he literally calls him Joe Pesci, doesn't he?
Yeah, and they're home invaders. And then, you know, the real curveball is just that Forrest Whitaker is a home invader with a heart of gold. So, mm-hmm. you know.
He's just trying to support his family.
Yeah. And
there's only so much he can do with a panic room security company salary.
Yeah. What was it that he said he needed it for some custody case or something? Like, there was some complicated whatever. I can't remember what the reason was.
I also forget because, again, regrettably, this is my fault and this is my failing as a human being. This movie doesn't hold my attention well enough for me to gather every little detail. And also, I didn't watch this with my fancy headphones to hear it better. I just watched it like a regular movie on TV, which was not the cinematic experience that was intended when this film was created. So I apologize. But yeah, I missed some of that stuff.
Well, don't tell David Fincher this, but I turned on subtitles.
Was it the talking quietly so Jodie Foster doesn't hear? Was it the mumbling or the echo sounds or just like easier to watch? Or was somebody, you know, like making margaritas in the kitchen while you're trying to watch?
No, it's just that it goes from the whisper quiety, you know, mumbly stuff to shouting, slamming, you know, crashing stuff in like 2 seconds. And to have the volume at a pleasant enough level to tolerate the smashing, crashing stuff, you really would miss out on some of the dialogue that was occurring in the whisper quiet moments. So I don't love having subtitles on most of the time when I'm watching things. I find it distracting. And the subtitles for this on Hulu have like weird line breaks in it, just FYI, in case anyone's curious or wants to fix that. If you work at Hulu, get in touch with me because I have some notes. But
by the way, when did they update the app so that when you're picking which user is watching, it's no longer a line underneath the name. It's actually a box around the name now. That's a huge innovation for them.
Yeah, I don't know that one. I wasn't keeping track. I only have one user logged in for my Hulu account the thought of creating additional accounts that won't be used by anybody else because we all just... Jason and I use my account here in the house on the Apple TV because it doesn't make a lot of sense to navigate in and out of different accounts because while the accounts all exist, while the profiles all exist and all these various services, they don't work together and they don't work well with the Apple TV. So I don't care for it. I just never bothered to do it for the Hulu for that reason.
You hear that, Hulu? Joe doesn't care for it.
Thank you, Hulu. Screw off.
Good day.
Yeah, I said good day to you, sir. I don't know. I would have enjoyed a more pleasant sound mix. Although I understand if you're watching this in a theater, it probably has the desired effect as opposed to watching it in a more home like setting. But maybe they could have just changed the sound mix for the home video release.
Nah. Mm-hmm. That's not how that works. That's not how cinema works.
Yeah, real cinema.
I just noticed the IMDb description underneath the title up here. A divorced woman and her diabetic daughter take refuge in their newly purchased house's safe room when three men break in searching for a missing fortune. And yeah, nailed it. I mean, most mm-hmm. of the time it's a pretty reduced summary of a movie, but that's it. That's all of it. That's what you got there.
Yeah. I was watching it. While I was cooking dinner and then Jason came down and he was asking me what was happening in the film. And I was able to summarize the entire film in like two seconds. So I was just like, wow.
You summarize it quick enough so that you don't miss any dialogue. You can kind of squeeze it in between things.
Yeah. I was like, this is actually surprisingly easy to recap because there's not a lot of wrinkles to it. You know, it's just like, you can imagine what home invasion is. You can, you know, just from, I feel like, because of the ripple effects of this movie existing, you know what a panic room is. I know what a panic room is because the movie exists, even though I hadn't seen the movie. So, you know, good job, movie. You educated people without even, you know, making people watch it.
Here's a cool thing that you'll never have in your home because you're poor.
Yeah. panic rooms and home theaters.
Hmm. Oh, man, I want a home theater so much.
What if you had a home theater and the panic room? You'd be set.
That would be amazing if there was, like, reclined, comfortable seating and large screens and surround sound in my panic room. And, you know, it's thick walls, too, so I could crank that stuff up and the neighbors wouldn't notice.
Right, right, right. Especially if you need to, you know, watch Panic Room in there. You don't want people to think you're actually in distress or to call the police. So it'll be muffled enough through the concrete that you'll be okay.
Yeah. What do you think the sign was that was the giveaway to the cop that something was actually going down?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the cops came back. Like, they got the subtle message that, you know, things aren't okay in the house.
No, Dan. The cops came back because gunshots were fired.
Well, that same cop was there, so clearly he was like, he didn't call in and go like, hey, okay, over here, wild goose chase.
Yeah.
He was like, dispatch, maybe keep an eye on this one and have a SWAT team on standby. Although, you know, the gunshot was silenced. I guess when they break the window open, there's broken glass and then there's lots of screaming and stuff. But they all got back there very quickly. So It seemed like the officer had some suspicions still. But I wonder if there was anything that really tipped his hand in that conversation other than just like, she's not playing into it here, but also she's acting very unusual.
Yeah. Well, and they did say that the neighbors reported the noise too. So I wonder if the neighbors were more on edge and observing the additional noises that were occurring, because it wasn't quiet for the last part of the film. But
it's also New York, so like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
it's kind of par for the course in New York.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't get the read that he was like, I got a hunch about this lady who said three things. So we're going to wait here in my car and we're going to call in a SWAT team and we're all just going to wait here on the street. And then eventually we'll hear a gunshot. Then we'll all go in. So I feel like there was enough time from when all of the commotion started at the end of it to when the cops showed up that it's plausible that they could have been there quickly. But
also, I guess if you're a beat cop working the 4 a.m. shift or whatever, like, they're just going to get back in the car and drink coffee. Like, where are they going to go? They're probably just like park around the corner or something. They're probably not far. They're just kind of hanging out until they get a call for something.
Yeah, and I'm glad the movie doesn't waste our time with cutting to the cops waiting in a car somewhere to be like, oh, I know that lady. She's got something's up. Something suspicious is happening. Like, we don't need that
shot. Or there could have been, like, one more extreme close-up of Jodie Foster, like, making eye contact with the cop as she closed the door or something.
No, I mean, I don't think the movie wanted you to have that, though, because this is the kind of ending where everyone gets exactly what they deserve. And one of those things they deserve is the police. So why bother wasting everyone's time on, well, like, Forrest, we really need to let better. You know the police were tipped off.
Like you said, he was a home invader with a heart of gold. He saved them. And also, he was just trying to save his family. He was just, he made a mistake.
Yeah, well,
maybe there should be a post or pre or mid or post credit scene where we see his day in court and see some lenience because Jodie Foster testified for him.
But I don't care. This is sound difficult. This is going to sound cantankerous from me. But I don't care about the outcome of Forrest Whitaker's character because he was punished because he did something he knew he shouldn't do. And even though he had the morals to not kill these innocent people and to kill this murderer,
And he gave Kristen Stewart her shot to save her life.
Right. But that doesn't absolve him of what he put everyone through by participating in this process. And he could have quit at any time he wanted to up until Jared Leto was killed.
Shot him in the head.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was like, well, now you got, you have fewer choices, to be making here. But he could have been plotting how to get away from him, especially when the gun was no longer there. I don't know. When he leaves and goes to the backyard, and then they keep cutting back to him, and he's like, sort of numbly, you know, having his foot slide off the wet leaves on the stoop as he's trying to climb the fence.
Bad at climbing walls.
Yeah, I was just like, why are there like five shots of this? Just like, we get it. You feel your heartstrings tugging you, your conscience tugging you to go back in and save this family. But I don't know. It seems preposterous. But
crab brain.
Yes. But it just doesn't. It doesn't make him a good person, and so I don't really care to find out what the good outcome is for him, because there isn't one really. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to cut to him and he's in jail and it's like, oh, judge reduced my sentence because I saved the family of this person, and the other guy in the cell will be like, yeah, whatever, shut up.
Yeah, like, I mean, Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart could go visit him in jail and like bring him a care package or something.
I don't think they want to do that since they're moving out of the house they just moved into. I feel like they want to not revisit that or anyone connected to it. I don't think anyone's going to communicate to Forest Whitaker's character at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got to move out. It's probably hard to get mashed finger out of your panic room door jam. Mm.
Yeah. So happens when you jam your fingers.
Would you be like him, and would you pick up your severed fingers and put them in your pocket?
You know, they say it can be reattached if you put them on ice.
You put in a glass of milk?
Well, he didn't seem all that interested in preserving them so much as keeping them, which I feel like are different strategies.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a leave no evidence or something.
Yes. he's definitely... Oh, I don't really understand... I'm glad the movie doesn't spend too much time setting up how Jared Leto came to get Dwight Yoakam involved in this, and Dwight Yoakam's complicated history with the law, which I'm sure one exists, because it makes him more mysterious and more interesting and more unpredictable. So I'm sure there is more to Raoul than meets the eye, but the film gives you just enough where... I am entertained by that, and no more.
Mm. Okay. Raoul. You should change your name to Raoul.
The role of Raoul was originally offered to Maynard James Keenan, whom Fincher directed in a music for A Perfect Circle's Judith. Hoy.
Imagine if you had Maynard and Jared Leto in here.
Keenan was too busy as lead singer for Tool, so Fincher then offered the role to Yoakam, knowing him from his performance in Sling Blade. For the role of Junior, Fincher cast Leto, who was cast in Fincher's previous film, Fight Club. As part of an atypical class division, Junior is the uptown rich kid, while Burnham's blue collar and Raoul is undefinable. Yeah.
Undefinable. Be undefinable is what they said. Doesn't he call him a truck driver at some point?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's his actual job or where he found him or something.
Yeah, but I think he said bus driver, truck driver. Anyway.
Bus driver. There you go.
So Patrick Bacow? Anyway. I've seen him in things before. He's like generally a character actor, so I was surprised to see him in this. And I didn't realize until just this very moment, is that when Jodie Foster calls on the phone, when she rigs up the phone line, that she's talking to Nicole Kidman, who has an uncredited vocal cameo there as as the other woman who the husband left her for.
This movie did not do well, I just noticed, on the box office. First of all, I was surprised it only cost $48 million, which I guess... still a lot of money for a movie that only takes place in one building, even though they built that whole building and they built a little bit of the street outside so they could just drench it with water and destroy the whole thing. But opening weekend, $30 million, gross worldwide, just under 200. That's not great.
That's surprising because, I mean, it was good critical acclaim for it. Ebert gave it 3 stars out of 4. The ideal thriller, existing entirely in a world of physical and psychological plausibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like if I'm anything on this show, I'm Mr. I love, you know, small scope movies that are, you know, compact and personal, but this one just doesn't do it for me.
Well, you're wrong. But
sorry, David Kep and David Finch, the Davids. Apologies to the Davids.
Apologies to the Davids. Title. I don't know. I don't know. I like this. It is pleasant enough. Maybe I don't have David Fincher on such a high pedestal. So when he does something that is above generally competent,
I don't know how much of it is a pedestal as it is just expectations based on what mm-hmm. he's capable of.
I would say you have some adoration and some high expectations from that adoration.
I mean, I just, given what he's done in the other movies, I'm aware of what he's capable of doing, and this seems fairly rudimentary for his abilities. And again, just. Maybe this should be factored into my whole theory, as discussed in the Fight Club episode that I just recently re-listened to, the whole how much credit versus how much blame he deserves for these things, because he is one part and he is not the all-seeing, all-knowing auteur that deserves credit for every little piece of everything he ever touches.
Right. And, I mean, I appreciate that about this role, because it doesn't feel like he has sort of his tentacles and everything, I guess. This, you know, it does feel like something that is written that is distinctly different from his other films. It doesn't feel like the same kind of dialogue or writing, even though there is a naturalism to it. It is not necessarily evocative of some of the other films that that he's participated in making. So it doesn't feel like he was like rewriting David Kep, you know, all the time or anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like even some of the other Fincher films, where while he likes a stable camera, there is a fluidity to movement in this that I don't feel like exists often in a lot of his other work. And so I appreciate a lot of what's happening here that maybe his opinion, of course, as the director influencing all of this, but it is definitely something where it doesn't feel like only David Fincher would have produced this outcome. Although it is interesting to think, like, I wonder if you would like this movie more if we were able to do like a, you know, blind taste test of like this movie and you didn't know who the director was, if you would have the same opinion of it, or if it is just because of, by virtue of his involvement, that it has colored your view.
Mm. If I didn't know it was him, I'd probably spend the whole movie going, what is wrong with this guy, and why is he doing this with this camera? Like, I get that you can, and in some places it helps, but something wrong with this person that he feels the need to do this with every single one of these crazy camera moves. And then you'd be like, oh, it's Fincher. Okay, I understand, because there's something broken about him in the way he needs to his cameras to move.
I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, to each their own. I'm satisfied enough with this outcome.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the movie. That's mm-hmm. all I've ever wanted, is to make you watch movies that you will enjoy.
Not just as punishment.
not just as punishment. I'm glad we got this out of the way, and I'm eager to move on to the next one, because I think you're going to have some thoughts.
Oh, so now I'm not going to like that one?
Oh, I'm not spoiling anything. I think you're going to have all kinds of thoughts. Good, bad, lots of stuff.
The good, the bad, and the ugly?
There's going to be, yes, there's good, bad, and ugly to discuss.
Okay. Well, on that note of an optimistic future, let's zolly out.
Mm-hmm. Are you a zolly out or zolly in fan?
I mean, I prefer zolly in, because then you're increasing the tension, unless it's that one shot in Poltergeist where the hallway keeps getting further away, which, you know, then zolly out, sure.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know whichever one they do in Jaws.
That one is in. Dolly in, yeah, because you're compressing the space in that one.
Wait, that compressing the space out, zoom in.
I always get it backwards. Yes, you're right. The camera is moving backwards. They're zooming in.
Yeah. Cameras are stupid.
So camera out, zoom in. So Zolly out then? Or is it Zolly in?
Because I'd say Zolly in because you're compressing in, right?
I guess. That's how I think of it, is like compression means in and you're zooming in, but you are dollying out. So you're doing in and out at the same time, which is the whole reason why there's a Zolly. So then which one is it when you're describing the overall move?
Which came first, the dolly or the zoom?